I'm Steve McLeod, and you are listening to The Community Lounge, the podcast where community managers from the video games industry tell their story, talk about the challenges they face, and share tips to help other community managers do their job better.
Today, I'm joined by John Lloyd. Lloyd is currently community lead at The Path, a games marketing agency. I've had the pleasure to meet John in person a couple of times at games industry events. Welcome to the show, John.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
You've been earmarked on my list of people to invite ever since I first met you at the event in Malmo in Sweden, Nordic Game, in which I think you came at the last minute, right?
Yeah, it was very much at the last minute. It was I prodded one of my clients because they were up for an award, and I was like, any chance I can come? And they were like, yeah, sure, you can come along. And I was like, yes, I'll come along there. Very last second.
Sounds like a nice client. Hey, let's talk about you and not about your clients at this point. Tell us about your path into community management. Where did it start for you? Now, you can start from when you're a little kid or when you're an adult or somewhere in between, as you choose.
Sure. For me, I didn't really know for a long time that I wanted to go into community management specifically. I knew I wanted to work with IT specifically. But, you know, if I like look back at my actual history, it was something I've always kind of done. As soon as I was allowed on, you know, the internet and was kind of, you know, playing Age of Empires 2, you know, RuneScape, you know, all these kind of games that were online and had like communities forming in various different places. So like places like MSN Gaming Zone, GameSpy, unfortunately they don't exist anymore, but they had the ability to kind of create your own kind of sub servers or channels. And I did a lot of these kind of things where I would go in and kind of pick something I wanted to do. It was very much a selfish kind of starting point. But I wanted to kind of find other people to, you know, that wanted to do the same thing, and I kind of built them up to be kind of like the primary place to go for those kind of, you know, specific game settings or whatever it was. So I kind of started there, and then every game I kind of went into, you know, through my childhood into my teenage years, even into, you know, my young adult life, I always kind of started my own community, you know, whether it is, you know, clans, you know, an MMO, so I could do, you know, the high-end content or, you know, the PvP, you know, tournaments for things like the standalone Gwent game, for example, or the Elder Scrolls TCG as well. So there was a lot of these different places where I always kind of built up my own community. Somewhere along the line, I realized it was something I wanted to do and effectively make a living from it because I really enjoyed it. And so I kind of continued to do those things until I found my way in, you know, in 2017 at Ubisoft for a kind of in a direction that happened? I applied for customer support because I had some experience in professional experience in customer support. I didn't get the job, but they actually said, we actually think you're going to be better for doing community management.
Fascinating.
Interview you for that. And I was like, yes, of course. That's kind of what I want to end up doing anyway. So I had the interview, and the same day they called me back saying, yeah, you've got it. So it was very much a thing of, that was my, you know, entry in. And then since then, I've kind of, you know, been jumping from place to place to, you know, do what I've been doing. And now I've landed here at The Path. So it's been pretty, it's been all over the place, but it's been really, really, you know, good for me. A lot of experience. It's been good memories.
Whoever was interviewing you at Ubisoft, kudos to them for having the judgment to realize that, although this guy's not right for the role he applied for, he's perfect for something else and we want him. That's really amazing. It's a common thing. Yeah, go.
And say, yeah, I think I was very lucky as well in that sense, because they were only hiring at the time internally for that. So it was very much a last second thing of, there has, you know, a few people internally that they were going to potentially bring into that role. And they already had those interviews done, but they, you know, brought me in very much last second to do that. So yeah, very lucky.
It's been a recurring theme in this series of podcasts of people who are doing the job of a community manager before they were a community manager, like as a volunteer. And that's exactly what seems to have happened here with you.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely did a lot of volunteering as well along, you know, that path, where, like, as soon as I realized I wanted to do it, I mean, it did take me a very long time, in all honesty. It probably took me from the point where I realized to when I got my first, you know, professional job in specifically community management. It took like 7 years. So I was doing a lot of, yeah, volunteering. I volunteered at a few LAN events. I volunteered at a few other kind of in-person events where obviously they don't have the manpower to kind of do everything themselves. They do need the help. And I had a little bit more of a an actual experience in, you know, creating and hosting, and in some cases, even just knowing, you know, XSplit, for example, back when they were starting to look at, you know, broadcasting it online with, you know, with specifically that program at the time, but trying to find cheaper ways to do the broadcasting, basically, because obviously Twitch just about was forming in like 2012. So yeah, it was a lot of conscious decisions that kind of led me down towards my final destination, basically, and thankfully not the one that is the movie.
That's amazing, though. It takes so long. It really does take a long time. There's something a little bit tragic about the one part of the story. When you mentioned that MSN Games and GameSpy don't exist anymore, and there's many of us today building up things online, building up tools and sites and applications and communities. The reality is in 10 or 20 years' time, people will be telling the stories, oh, I was using that thing back in the day, but that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, and it is very sad, because especially because when you think about the potential about some of these tools as well. So like, you know, MSN Gaming Zone and GameSpy, you know, if you think about it, those in particular, they were very easy to use, where literally, okay, I want to play this game. You click on the game, it would take you to, you know, all the servers that are being hosted, you know, the multiplayer servers and chat rooms that are hosted for those games. And then you just join a server and then you're done. But it kind of went away for a time because people just wanted to get in quick and easy. And now people are kind of slowly kind of wanting these, you know, server lists so they can find exactly what they're wanting. So it's kind of coming back again. And it's, I think part of it is probably because of Discord, right? People are joining these servers to try and find people to play with, but only in, you know, specific ways. So they know exactly what they're wanting, but they can't quite find that with Discord, but they can kind of narrow it down with it. So this is why I think Discord's had the rise it has had, because of exactly that.
It enables you to be in the community with the people you want to be in the community with.
Yeah, so exactly.
Let's move on. I asked you in advance if you were willing to share a story of a challenge you faced as a community manager. And you asked me that if it would be okay to share something particularly dark. And I am happy to hear that, because I think these stories have to be told. Would you like to tell us about this particular challenge you've faced as a community manager?
Sure. Obviously, a bit of a trigger warning for, you know, people who might be listening in around death, basically. So with that kind of mentioned, there have been multiple times in my career where something's happened that a very select few within a community are very opposed to a decision that has, you know, impacted how they have played a game, which has resulted in them, for whatever reason, deciding to send death threats.
Wait, this is a decision you've made or a decision that the game studio or publisher has made beyond your control?
Completely on my controls. This was like a balance change for a weapon, for example. So, you know, for a lot of people, they might be annoyed at that. But generally speaking, you know, a lot of people can be incredibly passionate about, you know, you know, the games they really like, which is great. But unfortunately, there are these, you know, certain times on the thankfully rare occasion, but it happens more often than you'd like, where, you know, this change is done and their first reaction is pure anger and frustration that kind of then scales to them sending death threats. You know, they've never mean it. They say it in just pure anger, or very rarely do they actually mean it, I should say. But it is just coming from a place where they're so angry, where they feel like it is the right thing to do. And it can, unfortunately, in certain times, kind of, especially if it's done in public, other people who are similarly, you know, as frustrated about a change might jump on that and also start sending these death threats. And it is generally very direct towards a studio, but every now and then when you are kind of like the known face of that game, they are directed at you specifically. And it's difficult, right? Because, yeah, you know, there is this point in your mind, you have to try and parse it in such a way that you go, you know that it's not real in the sense of they're not going to come knocking on the door with, you know, a weapon or a way to hurt you. But it's very hard to kind of move away from that and actually get your brain to remember that, because you're getting these you know, threats to your life, or in some cases even them saying we're going to bomb your studio.
No,
which we've had as well.
They wrote this publicly or in private communication?
Publicly in some cases. Ooh. It's not always private. A lot of the time it is public. And say for a studio, and death threats as well, you have to take these seriously on the, you know, small chance they are real. And that ends up impacting everyone, you know, in that studio, or if it's, you know, a remote studio or a remote team, then you don't have a place to, you know, evacuate for the day. In some cases, it is literally my home.
So how do you feel when you've received a death threat, and especially if it's been personal? What feelings, what emotions are you experiencing at the time?
Multiple levels to it. At least the way for me is the way I kind of process it. There is that brief moment of, at least for me, where I'm going, okay, what do I need to do? So I would take, get evidence of what was said. And I would then, you know, go, okay, is there any public information or private information, depending on the, you know, where I'm working at the time, that I can potentially gather to then effectively, either, depending on the process, pass it along to someone who will then use, you know, that information to effectively alert, you know, the local authorities, both in, you know, the location where the studio is, but also where the person doing threatening is based. Because obviously, you know, if we do have that information, then we can literally just reach out to the local authorities to where they are and say, we don't know where this person lives. Sometimes we do, because obviously people buy things online and it's a physical thing. We have to send it to them. But sometimes we don't. So we have to say, hi, this person, we don't know where they live, apart from it's in your city or town or whatever it is, has done these and said these things. Can you please make sure it's not a credible threat? Once that's kind of done, or in, you know, if it's very much a public outcry moment, I, you know, and I've kind of said my piece where, you know, a couple of times I've literally had to say to people like, look, stop sending death threats to each other, because that has happened in the past. And to me and my, you know, my team on, you know, the server, you know, it's Discord or on social media or wherever it is, you know, just please just stop. It's not right to do, or whatever I say at the time. And once I've kind of said that, I'll in some cases just locked the server down so no one can say anything in some cases, you know, I will literally then step away from my computer. You know, let my, you know, the team that I'm working with know that I've, you know, I've just gone through that. If they, you know, they're not, you know, it's my manager kind of thing, that they may not necessarily know the extent of what's happened until I tell them. So I'll tell them and go, look, I need to basically take time away. And I'll let you know how I feel tomorrow, depending on when it happens. I will then take, you know, a step away from, you know, my computer, social media, literally all these different places, and go out of my house and, you know, find some, you know, send a message to my friends and say, hey, can I come round, and literally just spend some time with friends. And effectively just to try and distract myself away from it.
A very healthy approach, very healthy.
Yeah, and it very much helps a lot. The problem then comes down the line where it's okay, I need to go home again. I now need to, you know, I'm in my own space where, you know, in some cases I don't have anyone else to talk to. I'm alone with my own thoughts. And that's where it kind of starts to dwell, and it starts to, you get those kind of thoughts of, am I actually safe? And it very much becomes a difficult few days mentally, even if consciously you're going, okay, I feel okay. You know, kind of subconsciously you're not, because like you're not sleeping as well. And, you know, if it's really kind of, if you're able to notice that it's affecting you, like you have to have days away. Like I ended up having, like the last time it happened, I ended up having to have effectively a week away from work and reaching out to, you know, a professional therapist and say, look, I've gone through this. I need counseling, you know, for, you know, it might just be a session just to talk about it, but it can also be, in some cases, it could be, you know, 1 to several months of counseling just to kind of move past it and be, you know, fully mentally healthy again, or at least to a point where you can kind of just function normally
and no longer being triggered by every noise you hear outside at night.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The closest I have had to that feeling was when the house I was living in by myself got broken into, and that night I couldn't sleep all night. I actually had to call a friend and say, please come over, because I feel I just need someone else here in the house with me so I can at least get through the night. But that's not even a touch on death threats. I guess the common thing here is that your feeling of safety is being violated.
Yeah, I think, you know, especially in, those situations, you know, the people sending those death threats don't actually understand the impact it is having on someone. And like, you know, almost every time it's happened and, you know, the process has kind of fully gone through and all the rest of it, you know, we generally would get a message literally the next day to them apologizing, because they obviously, the police have come and said, basically checked that no, it wasn't a credible threat. And unfortunately, a lot of the time it's, you know, teenagers that have said this without thinking, and then they end up having to explain to their parents why the police have knocked down their door at midnight. And it, you know, I would like to think that kind of almost shock moment of, oh, there is this genuine consequence to something I've said online, has kind of made them realize that not to do it, to treat people, you know, online how you would treat them in person, you know, these kind of thoughts. But
A learning moment for them, but
yeah,
you've paid a heavy price for them to have a learning moment.
Yeah, and that could be just one person. So, you know, if this happens, you know, on a day-to-day basis or week-to-week basis, which it does, you know, in some places, right?
Hey, listeners, a short interruption. When I'm not hosting the Community Lounge, I run Feature Upvote, a platform for managing player feedback. When you use Feature Upvote, your players can submit and upvote suggestions to improve your game in a single place. This gives you the data you need to develop a game that meets player expectations. And you can say goodbye to the confusion of trying to keep up with feedback scattered across discussions on Discord and Steam and Reddit. Learn more at featureupvote.com.
Don't you wish you were a community manager for cozy games? The ones in which there is nothing that can upset people?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I would like it to, you know, people not to get upset ever anywhere, mm-hmm. at any point. And I would imagine there will always be a subsection, even, you know, with a cozy game, even, you know, that I'd like to think it would never happen with a cozy game. But I also know in reality that might not be, you know, realistic. It might have a significantly lower chance that it probably hasn't actually happened. I would hope so. But
with a game like Stardew Valley that has a big enough player base and the game is comprehensive enough, surely there must be one or two people there.
Yeah. Well, it's a question of numbers, right? At that point, where you could have a million people and it only takes one.
Exactly. To ruin your day and your week. Let's move on to something more positive.
Yes.
You told me also that you're doing some mentorship work with an organization called Limit Break. Do you want to tell me what that is and what you're doing there?
Sure. So Limit Break is a place for, generally speaking, disadvantaged people to find a mentor to help them in their chosen career. So this is, you know, predominantly within gaming, but it is almost every avenue within, you know, the gaming sphere. So it could be from, you know, voice acting all the way through to community management to managerial. It could be, you know, someone who is doing one thing. So, for example, you know, community management for me. But say if I wanted to move into being a story writer, then I could try and find someone to mentor me on how to do that going forward. But it's a way for people to, whether it's new or already in the industry, to get kind of one-to-one support with someone who already has experience in the role that you are trying to move into. And I think it's incredibly, incredibly valuable. And it's a way for me personally to kind of pass on my skills, experience, and hopefully help someone kind of, you know, find a job to make a living off it and, you know, be better at it, you know, because, you know, they had the support from myself to do that.
This is UK based?
Yes. So it was based, it was started by a lovely person called Anissa. And, you know, she kind of started it from scratch, I believe by myself, but don't quote me on that, to kind of, as I said, kind of help people. So it's all started in the UK. We do have people from around the world, but it's primarily UK-based.
Okay. And you're mentoring people who want to become a community manager, I guess, your specific role.
Yes,
here.
Exactly. So I'm purposely only mentoring one person to begin with, just so I can kind of ease myself into it, because, you know, I'm not someone that has actively, you know, taught someone before or anything. So I was like, I'll start with one and kind of go from there, just to try and, you know, help this person to hopefully get work in the future. And so far, it's been a positive experience on my side. I would hope it would be the same thing for her as well.
Perhaps as a consequence of this podcast episode, you're going to get a few more people ask you for mentoring.
Very welcome to help in that case.
I do a little bit of mentoring and some formal paid coaching. And I have to say, I find it so satisfying helping someone else get better at what they're doing. Really satisfying. And one-on-one doesn't scale, and I'm fine with that. You know, one-on-one is the best sometimes.
Yeah, and it becomes a lot more personal that way, in my opinion. So I tend to prefer one-to-one. But it's like, you know, in the kind of the state that the industry is in at the moment, I do kind of slightly worry for programs like this, because I'm sure there are ones that are kind of based in America and other places around the world as well, that are probably, you know, struggling to get, you know, donations or sponsorship, because they are all charities, right? A lot of the vast majority of the time, especially this type of one. So, like, you know, just as a general thing, you know, if you have, you know, a way to support, you know, these programs to those that are listening in, you know, you definitely should. They're so valuable, and it helps in a, you know, a practical way. It helps us all in the long run, because we'd end up having, you know, more skilled people that will end up creating the next Stardew Valley, or, you know, helping us on our teams or whatever it ends up being, because we will know that they'll be better at their job and that they will have, you know, these skills and experience that how they've kind of been helped developed by mentors and the, you know, other mentees, if I can say that correctly.
It's always strikes me as a strange word, mentee. Now, this is a audio first podcast, but we also do have video available on YouTube, and the people on video should just be able to see that you're wearing a badge of Limit Break there.
Yes,
proudly.
Which is not very clear because of it's kind of quite small. But yes, I'm very proudly wearing my badge.
So we'll have a link to that in the show notes where people can go and check it out and maybe even sponsor it if that's something that you're able to do. I want to move on to talk about The Path, which is the games marketing agency you work at. I think you're the first person I've had on this podcast working for an agency rather than for a studio or a publisher. I'm not 100% sure, but I think that's the case. So I want to talk about that a little bit. Now, this is what I got from The Path's website. It's a games marketing agency built on a simple belief that brilliant people do brilliant work. So I assume you're the brilliant people it's talking about. Tell me what it's like being a community manager at an agency rather than specifically in a studio.
Sure. So obviously there is there are quite a few difficulties in being agency as a community manager, and, you know, other roles as well, I would imagine. But at least for myself, a role that is very entwined with both a studio and its fan base, and I'm kind of having to slot in between those two, can be incredibly challenging, because, you know, a lot of these times where, you know, I obviously we have multiple clients, right? So it's balancing, you know, these multitudes of clients with their needs and wants, while also obviously in community, balancing the needs and wants of their communities as well, while kind of trying to ensure that, you know, the bridge between the studio and the player base is, you know, as robust as possible. So like that's kind of one of the main like challenges that I currently, you know, and it will always face. But for me, I kind of, one of the things I will always say to a client, you know, during a kickoff or, you know, the first meeting or whatever it would end up being is, you know, I want to be transparent. You know, I will tell, you know, a client or a member of the community if they need, you know, about whatever it ends up being. So I would say, you know, for example, this is what I personally believe in what community management is, because everyone has their own differing opinions, and also different clients, as I said, will want different things. So I would say, you know, this is what I believe community management is. Basically, making sure that we're on the same page. Once we are on the same page, I would then say, okay, I want to be a part of any relevant meetings around the game, so I know what's happening with the game, so I can then kind of develop anything around the community that they may want based on the information I'm getting internally. So I have to be, you know, a part of effectively the studio or the indie, you know, because they're not necessarily all studios, just so I can make sure that I'm giving the correct information to the community. But also it means that I can raise up any issues or struggles that the community may be currently facing in that specific moment to them directly as well, in a, you know, generally in a format that I would have previously asked for, you know, what they want that format to be in. So some cases it would be a, you know, just a basic Word document. Other cases it would be, you know, an Excel doc, depending on what exactly a studio may be wanting. So yeah, it's a lot of work. Okay.
So you're coming in as the expert. Would you typically go and work full time on one game for 3 months, or would you work on three games all for longer, one for 2 days per week, another one for 2 days per week, and one for 1 day per week? Which is the way you tend to juggle your time as a community manager working at an agency?
It honestly depends and changes depending on the needs of a client. So some clients, you know, they may only need me to be working, you know, full time a day a week.
Okay.
Or for at least that amount of hours a week. So it could be as little as 5 to 10 hours a week. But obviously, there will always be situations where they'll need me to work more, you know, because, you know, someone's happening, there's a launch, there's a beat, or whatever it is, where I need to be more active. Mm-hmm. So obviously, in that situation, you know, I still have my other clients that, you know, if things align badly or badly is not the right word, but, you know, coincidentally at the same time, then I can't be in multiple places at once. So there would be that situation where I would, you know, reach out to, you know, one of my kind of trusted other community managers in the industry that are primarily work freelance or are in between jobs at that moment, be like, look, I need support for, you know, a week or two, you know, this is what we can pay you. Is that, you know, in the right range for what you are, you know, looking for that kind of work? But we would know, generally speaking, all of if things are lining up that way in advance.
Yeah.
It's not a last minute thing. Very rarely is it a last minute thing. So we can actually plan and prepare, but that's just, you know, it's just project management, right? At that point, where it's just making sure that, okay, we need this for that. So we make sure we have this for that. And thankfully, I've got a network of, you know, people I can rely on for that. Not needed it yet, but I'm sure I will do.
It's such an industry built on relationships and knowing people and making sure you keep meeting up with people. As has been my experience with you, like you helped me at Develop Brighton get into an event I didn't even know about and actually turned out to be a very useful event for me in the way that I actually ended up spending a lot of money with somebody who had the services I needed. I was actually going to Develop trying to get customers. So I ended up going there and becoming a customer, but that's a story for another day. John, we have run out of time and haven't even got through half the stuff I wanted to talk to you about, but I do want to leave the conversation with one final question, the most important question. What game have you been playing lately?
Past week or so, actually the past few weeks, I've been kind of diving back into Guild Wars 2 personally. I'm personally excited for the new expansion, but you know, there's a massive and great community in that game, and it's pretty respectful of the amount of time I can put into it. So I don't feel rushed to do, you know, all the different things. So it's quite it's a nice, relaxing game that I can do and spend as much time in as I want, and that's nice. And
you say you're getting back into Guild Wars 2. Does that imply that you've played it a lot in the past?
Yes, definitely. I've been playing it on and off since the game originally released, and I played the first one as well. It was one of those games that I kind of built a community in back in the day.
Okay.
So ended up one of the best clans for a few weeks, where we managed to win the right game, so we just ended up at the top for a bit. That didn't last very long, but it was very much just
it never does.
It was just a thing of, you know, we'll do it for a bit of a laugh, and it ended up doing really well. I'm like, oh, cool. We're not actually bothered about it. We just thought it was kind of fun. So yeah, I've kind of come back into it, as I always do, you know, multiple times a year, because as I said, it's very respectful of my time. So I enjoy it a lot.
More people in the industry and outside of the industry than we would care to believe keep coming back to the same game over many, many years. I have one or two that for more than 10 years, I've kept coming back to them because there's a familiarity, and sometimes you just have half an hour. You want to play games, you can't put in more time than that because, you know, we're busy people.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think it's even better when, you know, these games can accommodate that as well, because not every game can and not every game does. But the games that, you know, are able to kind of respect your time like that will always have people kind of coming back. And I think that's fantastic. And in some cases, you end up bumping into the same people that, you know, maybe not have spoke to for many, many years. And they've come back at the same time, and it ends up being kind of, oh, how you been doing? So I think that's really nice.
Well, that's all we have time for today. John, thanks again for being on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Where can listeners get in touch if they'd like to know more about what we've discussed today?
Sure. So you can find me on LinkedIn at @Seriax. So that is Seriax. Alternatively, you can reach out to me via email, which is john@thepath.agency. So you can find and talk to me at those places. And then obviously for Limit Break, it's simply just limitbreak.co.uk.
And I'll have all three of those in the show notes. Bye, John.
Thank you for having me.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks again for listening to this episode of the Community Lounge. If you enjoyed this episode, please spread the word and share it with friends and colleagues who you think would also enjoy it. You can find all the episodes on your favorite podcasting platform or at featureupvote.com/thecommunitylounge.